From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. Now, this program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, I really do appreciate you doing that. Thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Last week, we started the show with what I felt was a deeply moving response to the brutal slaying of a young black man in Georgia from the Reverend Otis Moss III. The response took the form of a sermonic film titled The Cross and the Lynching Tree, A Requiem for Ahmaud Arbery. But we were given almost no time to reflect and organize a faithful response before a shocking killing in Minneapolis galvanized the attention of the nation. 46-year-old George Floyd, an African-American father of two, posing no threat nor accused of any violent act, died in plain sight, repeating, "I can't breathe," over and over again as an armed police officer's knee dug into his neck. There were other police on the scene. There were bystanders. There's video. While it's commendable that the officers involved were immediately fired, the mayor of Minneapolis found himself having to call for an arrest, even as outraged citizens staged protests that turned violent. There has been intense conversation in progressive circles around another viral video that spread this week. A white woman in New York Central Park, asked by a black man to leash her dog as required by law, responded by immediately calling the police to report an attack by, quote, a man, African American. As reports multiplied that the woman was a longtime donor to Democratic political campaigns, a number of articulate commentaries have appeared making a similar point. Far too many Americans who consider themselves enlightened liberals, who vote for progressive candidates and support inclusive causes, who move easily in multiracial and diverse circles, still live their lives with latent privilege always at the ready. Live their lives with the ability to fall back on a level of presumption of innocence and shared preferred features should they ever need or be triggered to. My saying this is not a reflexive expression of some kind of collective white guilt. It's not an exercise in knee-jerk political correctness. It is a recognition of the brutal reality that every black person in this country lives with routine experiences that I can't even imagine, experiences that condition expectations that I don't know that I could even live with. I do not consider myself to be racist. And having grown up in an extraordinary racist world, it's easy for me to see the difference between there and here, then and now. But if Ahmaud Arbery can die in Georgia and his case languish for weeks in a law enforcement system dominated by men who look like his killers, if Amy Cooper can feel entitled to endanger a fellow New Yorker's life with a call to police and the buzzwords, man, African American? If George Floyd can be murdered by four uniformed police officers in full view of onlookers and video cameras, and the arrest of his killers drags on as if somehow more clarity were needed, then racism is nothing less than a crisis in our nation. The scenes, yet again, of violent protests and fires burning in one of our great cities are heartbreaking, but they are also another chance to break through the illusion of justice and equality we soothe ourselves with far too often. The fact is, white nationalists, neo-Nazis, and other overt racists in this country are not going to come to their senses. Those among us who keep racial privilege in a back pocket, just in case a moment comes when we need to deploy it, may pay lip service to racial justice, but aren't making our society more just if we can step out of that equation whenever we feel the need to do so. We should be hearing much, much more from the faith communities and faith-based organizations that are so quick to denounce transgressions of what they self-servingly define as religious liberty and pro-life values. Only people of true goodwill and commitment are ever going to make real change. That means facing the reality of just how much desperately needs to change still, and then living out the immortal words of the poet June Jordan, revived so powerfully by Barack Obama, "We are the ones we've been waiting for." Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
But I also felt like it was important to assert the ways in which religion was being used by, certainly by this president and some of his followers, and what not just his espoused or ostensible faith, but any faith might ask of us. And you know, frankly, I saw again, just in the last few days, what I took to be a very political maneuver by the president, claiming that he had the power to order all of the churches and houses of faith back open. And then when the sun came up on Sunday, as far as anybody can tell, there's no evidence of him going anywhere but the golf course. I do think that this needs to be discussed, that there has to be some relationship between who somebody is and what somebody says.
Pete Buttigieg is a young, energetic war veteran who evoked memories of several past Democratic presidents during his run for the 2020 nomination. Although dropping out early in the cycle, the former Indiana mayor inspired legions of LGBTQI plus young people as to what will be possible in their futures. On this week's show, we'll hear the thoughts of Mayor Pete on the desperate situation the nation now finds itself in.
That night, the door was locked, and I started calling. I was like, "Mama, open the door, I'm here." And she looked at me and she said, "You're never getting back in this house."
Award-winning filmmaker Daniel Carslake burst into prominence a decade ago with his powerful documentary for The Bible Tells Me So. It helped set the tone for discussing LGBTQI lives and religion. And now Dan has followed up with a new film, For They Know Not What They Do. This current pandemic precludes a traditional national premiere in movie theaters, but this important work was unveiled at the Tribeca Film Festival, and Dan will be back with us to talk about what's next. But first,
what a lot of Christians saw was that God was raising up this man, God intervened because people were praying for some kind of shift in our country.
Right.
So God answered our prayers in a way we didn't expect, with a man we didn't even necessarily like.
The fundamental question of how so many of the nation's leading televangelists, mega church pastors, and other influential faith leaders fell in lockstep behind the improbable presidential campaign of one Donald J. Trump and have stayed there, scandal after scandal, through impeachment and now through a failed effort to contain a pandemic that has claimed an unthinkable 100,000 innocent American lives, desperately needs to be answered. And answering it requires the kind of insights and understanding that few thinkers and writers possess. Thankfully, the unholy alliance of the political religious right and nakedly partisan priorities has been in the crosshairs for investigative journalist Sarah Posner for many years. She sounded an urgent warning in her 2008 book, God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. And she now has published a timely and comprehensive new volume titled Unholy, Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. This is a much-needed deep dive into the existential question of our age, and I am delighted that it brings my friend and colleague, Sarah Posner, back to State of Belief Radio. Sarah, congratulations on the book, and thank you so much for being with us again.
Of course, for having me, Welton.
You recount the chilling story of being leaked a draft executive order that seemed to reorient the very relationship between church and state in our nation. That was a pretty solid early warning of what was coming, wasn't it?
It was. This was just a couple of weeks into Trump's presidency back in 2017. I was leaked a draft executive order, which read to me like a wish list of what the Christian right had been advocating for and lobbying for years. Basically, wide open religious exemptions for conservative Christians who objected to LGBTQ rights, reproductive rights. And the way it was drafted, it could have been read to allow discrimination not just against women and LGBTQ people, but against other people for basically any quote unquote religious reason. And this was shocking on one level that so early in the Trump presidency that they were going to try to basically run over civil rights laws via executive order. But now looking back on it, I guess it doesn't seem so shocking that this would be the method by which they would try to do it. Now, Trump never signed that particular executive order, even though he was strongly urged to by his Christian right allies. But the Trump administration has chipped away in many other ways at LGBTQ rights and reproductive rights and expanded the religious rights for conservative Christians that in other ways, using other mechanisms. But that executive order, which was handed to me in January 2017, actually turned out to be pretty much a roadmap for what they wanted to do.
What are some of the promises the campaign offered the theocratic right that cemented the kind of loyalty many of us have been puzzled by during the administration?
Well, I think the important thing to understand about the way Trump's primary campaign went in 2016 was that the white evangelical base was ahead of the white evangelical leadership in supporting Trump. They were clearly moved by his campaign rallies, his bombast, his his racism. And there were a lot of elite, influential power broker types in the Christian right who were not yet backing Trump. They were backing Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz or staying neutral in the race. Mm-hmm. But over time, they began to see that the base, that Trump was the one that the base wanted. And we can get into the reasons why that happened. But as it became evident that the leadership was going to pretty much start following the base, they extracted promises from Trump in exchange for their support, which obviously, even with the base's support, it's important to have the support of the power brokers, of the influential leaders. Yeah. And those promises pretty much centered on judges promising Supreme Court justices who would overturn Roe, other federal court judges who would support their concept of religious freedom, and promises to staff his agencies and White House with other Christian right ideologues and loyalists who would govern from this quote unquote biblical point of view.
Mm-hmm. Would you say they've been able to achieve their most important goals successfully, or have the constitutional structures of our republic been able to resist at least some of the changes they wanted to make?
Well, I think that in some cases they have been successful. In some cases they've been successful by abusing the procedural mechanisms that are in place, for example, abusing procedural mechanisms in place to establish a process for revoking or reversing a federal regulation, for example. They've shortcutted that in a number of instances. I think the important thing to understand in this interplay between policy initiatives that they attempt to undertake and constitutional challenges to them is that simultaneously, the federal bench is being stacked, with Mitch McConnell's help, with judges who are more receptive to this point of view. So, for example, a case that's before the Supreme Court right now involves religious objections to foster care placement with same-sex couples. You know, so a religious foster care agency doesn't want to place children with a same-sex couple. This is a flashpoint for the Christian right. If the Supreme Court were to rule in their favor, that would be a huge victory for them. And even though, constitutionally speaking, you wouldn't, constitutional scholars would look at it based on previous court precedent and say, I don't think it would come out in their favor. But now the court has Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, you know, instead of Merrick Garland and somebody else. Yeah. And so it's conceivable that that case could come out in their favor. So I think you can't look at the policy initiatives or efforts in a vacuum from the courts.
I think it's easy to think of the promises as crassly calculated political manipulation, but it goes deeper, doesn't it? There really are some true believers at work behind some of this stuff.
Right. I think one thing that's important to understand about the Trump Christian right alliance is that some of it is transactional politics, right? So you have somebody like Tony Perkins or Ralph Reed, one of these people who leads a political organization. Tony Perkins leads the Family Research Council. Ralph Reed leads the Faith and Freedom Coalition. They meet frequently with Trump. They talk frequently with Trump. They're able to extract these promises because they are able to signal to the base whether they should be supporting Trump or not supporting Trump. But they are obviously signaling they should be supporting Trump. That's one level at which this support for Trump goes on. But there's another level that I think is less understood by people because it's less visible to us news consumers who are not as enmeshed in the evangelical subculture of televangelism and the prosperity gospel, and this idea that this movement of like self-proclaimed apostles and prophets who think that they are getting revelations from God about Trump and what God is doing with Trump. And so within that subculture, the support for Trump is less an analysis of these political considerations and more of a divine revelation. Trump is God's hand is on Trump. God wants Trump in office at this time for America. Trump is ordained by God. Trump is anointed by God. He's like King Cyrus in the Bible. And it's much harder to analyze that kind of support from a political point of view because it's just so deeply rooted in this subculture where it's completely normal and accepted to believe that God would be anointing political leaders and saving America from liberalism or saving America from political correctness or George Soros or whatever the conspiracy theory is.
There are certainly important distinctions between the American religious right and white nationalists. I think the latter have benefited in countless ways from the policies aimed at appeasing the former. But is that just coincidence, or has there actually been a deliberate effort made to woo those darker forces?
So there was no evidence that someone like Tony Perkins, who runs probably the most prominent religious right organization, the Family Research Council, met with Richard Spencer, probably one of the country's most prominent white nationalists. Oh. In fact, I would think there was a lot of antipathy between those two men. I've never asked Tony Perkins about Richard Spencer, but I've asked Richard Spencer about Tony Perkins, and they don't see each other as allies. And I'm certain that Tony Perkins would not want to be seen at a Tiki Torch march or at a conference where people were giving the Hitler salute. But the Christian right, the religious right, stood by as Trump winked and nodded at white nationalists, said that there were good, very fine people on both sides in Charlottesville. All of these dalliances that Trump had with white nationalists were pretty much left uncriticized by the religious right, pretty much throughout his primary campaign and definitely throughout his presidency. On the other hand, there is evidence that people within the Trump campaign were knowledgeable about the need to bring these two together. When I interviewed Steve Bannon at the Republican National Convention back in 2016, which was about a month before he was brought onto the Trump campaign, he told me point blank that you would need an alliance of the Christian right and the alt-right in order to win the election. I mean, he was pretty much basically telling me his number-crunching strategy. And as I discuss in a lot more detail in the book, this did not just happen by happenstance in the Trump era. There's a lot of sort of rooted common history where race is a very critical issue in the formation of the Christian right back in the 1970s. And so all of this needs to be understood in that historical context as well.
Yeah. Sarah, we all know public policy is sterile and abstract until it is implemented. And then it impacts countless lives in sometimes unpredictable ways. So could you talk about some of the real life ways that the religious right's playbook is affecting us right now?
Well, for example, Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos has said she's going to order public schools to give some of the money that they've received under the COVID stimulus to private schools, including private religious schools. That's one big glaring example. Right now, churches across the country are engaged in litigation and kind of litigation in the court of public opinion about whether stay-at-home orders and bans on large gatherings during this pandemic violate their religious freedom. And they have attracted not only Trump's attention, because we all know that Trump talked about how he wanted to order the governors to let the churches reopen, but it has also got the attention of the Justice Department, where Attorney General Bill Barr has spoken on the issue and has authorized a team of lawyers to intervene in some of these cases on behalf of the churches, not on behalf of the governors trying to keep the residents of their state safe, but on behalf of the churches who insist that it's a violation of their religious rights to have to comply with these stay-at-home orders. Those are just two examples that are pandemic related. And then there are a lot more that are not pandemic related, such as the Department of Health and Human Services undermining rules enacted in the Obama era to protect beneficiaries of government-funded programs from religious discrimination. So discrimination based on their sexual orientation or gender identity, or based on their marital status or what have you, but basically expanding the ability of taxpayer-funded organizations who provide social services to many needy people across the country, basically reopening their ability to discriminate based on religion.
Sarah, the recent confession by the woman known as Jane Roe in the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court case that she manufactured her public change of heart and anti-abortion activism thanks to hundreds of thousands of religious right dollars made me think of the confluence of money and theocratic politics that you analyze so astutely. Is this a one-off, or do we need to be less naive about other public testimonies and campaigns that may well be bought and paid for?
It's a really interesting question, because I really believe that the religious right really thrives on these conversion stories, right? They love the story of somebody who was once on the dark side and they saw the light, and they came over to the side of righteousness and Jesus, basically. It's fascinating with regard to Jane Roe. I mean, I had no idea about this until, and I haven't seen the film yet, but, you know, obviously read about it. These kinds of stories really fuel the narrative that the Christian right likes to tell, that anybody can be redeemed as long as you come over to our side. And our side is the side of righteousness and virtue and purity. And so, but it doesn't look so pure now that we know this about Jane Roe.
Many of the people that you write about are individuals that I dealt with early in my career. When you compare the early leaders of the Christian right with current leaders, are the people causing trouble now smarter, more politically adept than the first group? And I guess what I'm getting at with that question is the religious right at a place where it will be strong regardless of who's in the White House?
Yes. The short answer is yes. They will be strong regardless of who is in the White House. They're strong right now in a certain way because Trump has given them a great deal of leeway and basically a carte blanche to run his administration, to help pick judges, to basically dictate policy, but not just dictate policy, but to also dictate the narrative and the story and the drama around Trump. I mean, just today, the Christian Broadcasting Network ran an exclusive interview with Kayleigh McEnany, his new press secretary, glorifying and elevating her religious belief and her faith in Jesus and her salvation story, as if like that is the most important criteria or prerequisite to be the White House press secretary. But I think in a lot of ways, the history that I go over in and reveal in the book is very instructive about the staying power of the Christian right, because a lot of the history that I uncovered in my research sounds a lot like something that could happen today. So, for example, Robert Billings, who was possibly more instrumental in forming the modern religious right with Paul Weyrich than, say, Jerry Falwell Sr. was. And I would urge people to read the book to find out more about why I say that. But he became an official in the Department of Education under President Reagan. And it was discovered while he was serving in the Department of Education that he touted himself as a Christian school educator. He was a principal and a headmaster of various Christian schools, and he was basically a leader in the Christian school movement. And it turned out, it was discovered after he became an official in the United States government, that his PhD was from a diploma mill. And I remember reading that as I was doing the research for this book and thinking, that sounds so Trumpian. It sounds like exactly like something that would happen under Trump. Some guy gets installed at the Department of Education and it turns out he has a PhD from a diploma mill.
Does this mean that the historical period that we're talking about, were there things in it, warnings that we should have heeded that might have helped us take a different direction?
Well, yes. I think that's always true. Like, you know, in hindsight, you could look at things as being warnings and you should take a different direction. But mostly when you're looking back at this history, I mean, from my perspective, it's really more instructive in terms of how did we get here? Not what was the road not taken. And like I said, I think people should read the book because I go into a fair amount of detail about this, yeah. But the Christian right's antipathy towards the government doing anything that helps promote human dignity, civil rights, pluralism, a liberal democracy was evident in its early days. And when I say its early days, I'm talking about the late 60s, early 70s, you know, before what we think of as the formation of the modern religious right with the launch of the Moral Majority in 1979. And really what was driving them was not the Supreme Court's decision in Roe v. Wade in 1973, but the notion that the federal government wanted to play a role in ensuring that private Christian schools were not discriminating against Black students.
Yeah.
And this was their big crusade against the federal government. And when you look at that with historical hindsight, you see not only how much race was a factor and the sense of grievance that something was being taken away from them, but also the sense that the federal government trying to do something about race discrimination was equal to their religious rights being infringed upon, which I think is really instructive for what we're seeing now.
What's next? What's the call to action that comes out of the reporting that you've done in this important book and elsewhere? Because I refuse to believe that it's too late if enough people heed the warning.
Well, I think people really have to understand that Trump is not some weird aberration that just came out of nowhere and can be vanquished because there are a lot of anti-Trump conservatives who are very prominent on Twitter or on your TV, on CNN or MSNBC. That this is a political movement that has been aiming for a moment like this for a long time. Maybe they didn't envision Trump himself with all of his personal and sexual scandals, but they did envision having somebody who would snub his nose at liberal democracy, at civil rights, at the idea that America is a pluralistic, religiously pluralistic nation. And so there's a lot at stake here because Trump has taken their support and their unwillingness to question him and the unwillingness of the Republican Party to question him to expand presidential power to unprecedented extremes. So this election is not just about a Republican versus a Democrat. This election is about whether we're going to have a liberal democracy or not.
Sarah Posner is a reporting fellow with Type Investigations, a prolific writer at the intersection of politics and religion. Sarah has just published her latest book titled Unholy: Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. Sarah, this is such an important and timely work. I know many people will benefit from reading it. Thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. I'll talk with the award-winning filmmaker behind the new documentary, For They Know Not What They Do, Dan Carslake. And later, a few minutes with former presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg. Now, if you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows, all of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. In recent years, we've seen some invaluable books addressing the collision of anti-gay religion and queer spirituality and lives. The discussion was powerfully impacted by the award-winning 2007 documentary film, For the Bible Tells Me So, from filmmaker Daniel Carslake. A lot has changed. But a lot more still needs to be said on the subject. And thankfully, Dan is back with a new project titled For They Know Not What They Do, which brings Dan back to State of Belief Radio. Dan Carslake, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Welton. It's so good to be back. It's so good to see you and sit down and talk to you.
I think it's no overstatement that the tone of the entire conversation shifted with your first film. So what made you feel the need to revisit the topic again?
Yeah, I'm super proud of For the Bible Tells Me So. I have a lot of things that I'm concerned about in life and I want to make movies about. I didn't think I would make another film similar to For the Bible, but in August of 2015, while my husband and I were living in Germany, we still live here, I started getting, strangely, death threats through the For the Bible Tells Me So website again. I'd gotten many of them when the film was first released in 2007, but they had really fallen off completely. And then all of a sudden, in August of 2015, I started getting these threats again, and I said to my husband, what's happening in America right now that makes people want to threaten me again? And if they're threatening me for this old film, what's happening on playgrounds and in high schools and colleges to LGBTQ young people? So I think the next week was a presidential debate, like a Republican candidate presidential debate. There were about 10 people running for the Republican nomination at that point. They were all lined up in front of a plane, I think, in this debate. It was the first time that we had sort of tuned into something political in America because we weren't living there. Anyway, in that debate, I would say 8 out of 10 of those candidates said something proudly and unabashedly anti-gay and anti-trans. That was a huge switch from 2014 when we left the U.S., when maybe one or two of the sort of fringe candidates would be very strongly anti-gay. But here, 8 out of 10 of them were. So that very much unsettled me. I knew that marriage equality had happened in June, and I thought, this looks like a reaction to that. So I just started looking at what was happening state by state in the U.S., and I realized that there, even then, were more than 200 anti-LGBTQ laws being considered at the state level. And I thought, I think we're going to make another movie because this conversation has to continue.
The new film introduces four families, each dealing with this essential question of religion and acceptance. Dan, I wish you would talk about each of them just a little bit, please.
Sure. So the first story that I found, I'll tell them in the order that where I discovered the families. There's a conservative evangelical family in Seattle who I met through another friend of mine who really both of them were deep inside the very conservative part of the evangelical church. Both parents have four kids, and their 12-year-old son, Ryan, to their shock and horror, came out to them at the age of 12. Their whole community, their family, everyone, virtually everyone in their lives said that the right thing for them to do was to get him help, that God could change him. God is bigger than this, so he can change Ryan's sexual orientation. So Ryan was in and out of conversion therapy for 6 years. And the film tells that story and it sort of tells sort of what happened to Ryan as a result of that. Then I met Sarah McBride in Washington. Sarah is this incredibly capable, kind of super talent person. Sarah was born and was identified at birth as a boy. But after she became president of the student body at American University, she came out on her last day of her presidency as transgender and has become Sarah. And she had a great difficulty with her parents as well. But she has just really, even since we started shooting the movie, she has just risen like a phoenix. She's an incredibly impressive woman as a national spokesperson now for HRC. The third story was a story out of the Latinx community. That is another community that we missed talking about in For the Bible Tells Me So. So I was very, very interested in trying to find a family who was willing to talk about having a LGBTQ child from that community. And I found a beautiful family, the Baez Febos from Florida, whose son Vico was literally so worried about telling his father, his, you know, sort of macho Puerto Rican father, that he was gay. He really thought his dad was going to kill him. But Vico had a completely different experience when he came out to his parents. And it's really one of my favorite stories in the movie. It's absolutely beautiful. And then the final story was the story that I found the hardest to find. And that was a family of color with a transgender child. It's a really wonderful mixed race couple from Montclair, New Jersey, whose daughter came to them in eighth grade and said, "I'm a boy." And so they went through this long, difficult process of trying to figure out what their responsibility was as a parent to their child. Was this a phase? Was it not? And their son, Elliot, now is thriving in college. And it's a very simple story, but I thought it was an important story because the conservative narrative about transgender children is that the parents are really irresponsible. And, you know, what are they thinking? These kids don't know what they want, and they must take this so not seriously enough that they allow these kids to transition. And Colleen and her husband, the Porches, Harold, they took it extremely seriously, as of course every parent does. And so I just love that they were able to tell their story in such a simple, straightforward way. But they struggled, and then they did research and they educated themselves. And Elliot is now an incredibly happy sophomore in college.
Did this project leave you feeling optimistic or pessimistic about the subject, because as much as affirming and inclusive faith traditions have multiplied and evolved, the truth is that anti-gay religious rhetoric has been professionalized and weaponized in ways I think most of us could never have predicted.
You know, I think the answer is kind of twofold, Welton. I think in the individual personal basis, like one-on-one, human-to-human interaction, the movie and these stories leave me filled with hope, because I understand that still, as long as people come out and can be who they are and safely do that, then people can really change. Families can change. Communities can even change. The Robertson's community, this incredibly conservative evangelical megachurch that they're a member of, that they're members of in Seattle. When we screened in Seattle, a number of the senior clergy came and it shifted them. This church is on its way to becoming affirming. So people see these stories and one-on-one they change. Now there's another kind of component to your question, and that involves political ambition and the sort of thirst for power. And I think LGBTQ people will always be, at least in the near future, one of those groups that more conservative, unfortunately, politicians use to step on to get higher on the ladder, just like what's happening all over Europe. I was just on a 90-minute call with some students and teachers in Poland who have watched the film, and they have the same situation with their leader. But these people were so on fire after seeing the movie about how they were going to try to do everything they could to stand up for the LGBTQ community. So I have a lot of hope, but I also am realistic and realize that those with power constantly seek more power, and they do that by making an other of whomever, of LGBTQ people, black and brown people, whatever it is, whatever works in that moment. And right now in the U.S., we're in a moment where everyone's being othered pretty much.
Yeah. When you look back at For the Bible Tells Me So, what was it like to watch the reaction to that film? And did you feel like you reached the audience that you wanted to reach? And I'm asking those because I'm interested not only in the way I'm asking the question, but I also want you to follow that with, what do you see this film doing that is like that?
The reaction to For the Bible Tells Me So never ceases to amaze me. I can't believe the how far it's gone. It's in 24 languages now. I was just in Tokyo about a year and a half ago for the Japanese premiere, because Japan wasn't ready for it until 2018, even though it was 11 years old. It was just so incredibly moving to see that. And there are two different Bible studies that are based on For the Bible Tells Me So. One very conservative, paid for and written by a conservative United Methodist church in Dallas. And that Bible study has been used many times. That same church is interested in doing a Bible study for They Know Not What They Do. So, you know, For the Bible Tells Me So has been in something like 4,000 American churches, many of them struggling with whether or not to become welcoming and affirming. These aren't all progressive, preaching to the choir kind of churches. And I have no doubt, since our distributor is the same company, the people who distributed For the Bible are the people who are distributing for They Know Not What They Do. Well, they know everyone who had a screening of For the Bible Tells Me So. So they have already gotten the word out. You know, once we premiere, our premiere is coming up on June 12th. But once we premiere, then those kinds of screenings will start getting booked. So I'm very excited. The penetration that the first film got was much deeper than I thought into the territory that we most wanted to reach, and that is people who are not yet in favor of equality for LGBTQ people. You know, both movies are about family. It's just about family. And when people see them, they tend to really shift.
Yeah, yeah. I understand the linearity of how the first and second titles relate to each other, but there is more to the sentence from which the latest film draws its name. In Scripture, it's the crucified Christ who, with his last breath, says, "Forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do." I'd like for you to talk about the choice of these words for the film title and explain what that means to you so that people get the full understanding of it.
So, "For They Know Not What They Do," and why I chose that title, there's an answer on a number of levels. First of all, at a very sort of superficial level, it was important to me to again pick a title that I felt would appeal to the people we most want to reach first. So when this film, because eventually this film will go up on Amazon and iTunes and possibly Netflix and other streamers, and a lot of people are, you know, when they go on these sites, they look for things to watch. My hope is that when Christians, conservative Christians, see the title "For They Know Not What They Do," they'll think, "Oh, those are the last words of Jesus. That's probably a movie for me." So maybe they'll choose it. I have gotten thousands of emails from people who the same thing happened to them with "For the Bible Tells Me So," which is, of course, the second line of a Christian hymn called "Jesus Loves Me." People watched it only because of the title, and then they stayed with it and were changed by it. So superficially, I'm hoping people will see the title, who we most want to reach, and choose it. But really, on a much more deeper level, my community, the LGBTQ community, has had so much wounding and so much pain that's come from the church. There's often a lot of very negative, hate-filled rhetoric that goes back the other way against people in the church. And I understand that. I have been a victim of much of that negativity myself. I understand the wounding in gay people and trans people from the church. But I also believe that people deserve forgiveness. And the sort of double entendre of this title is that people who are Christian might come to the movie and think, "Oh, it's about gay people not knowing what they're doing." But actually, it's about these parents who, at one point or another, think that their faith or what they believe is their faith is more important than their child. And they often do things that are damaging and harmful to their children without even knowing it, especially the evangelical couple who really thought that this was exactly what they needed to do. So I want them to be forgiven. They deserve forgiveness because they didn't know what they were doing.
You know, I have to admit that the way you interwove the stories was so good. That particular couple struck me at first like a thousand people that I've known in my lifetime. And I honestly didn't know until, well, I shouldn't even say this, at the end of it, they surprised me. And they surprised me to a point that I felt tears in my eyes about it. You did that so beautifully. With the pandemic still raging and so many lives lost, anything that would ordinarily involve a mass audience has required complete rethinking. So what are the plans for getting the new film in front of as many people as possible?
So, yeah, we had planned a theatrical release into theaters in June, just in a few days, but theaters are all closed. So we've gone to a different model. It's a very new model. Instead of going straight to the streamers, the Netflix and the Amazons and the iTunes of the world, and letting, you know, in that situation, they're the ones who take all the benefit, all the financial benefit, we've discovered that there are independent film theaters all over the country, the theaters that I love, who show my films, not the big chains that show the big, you know, mega films, but the art theaters all over the country. Some of them have virtual cinema platforms. And so we've decided to support independent theaters all across the country by opening the film on June 12th. You can go to our website at ForTheyKnow.org, click on Find Your Theater. And how that works is you pick your favorite independent theater, your neighborhood theater, whatever theater you want, the theater you grew up going to but live far away from now, whoever you want to support. And if you buy your ticket there, ticket really meaning a rental, just like on the streamers, you know, if you buy a ticket, you'll have 72 hours to watch it. But the tickets will cost $10 each, and half of that will go back to the independent theater through which you booked the ticket, so that the bulk of the money will go to the theater instead of to some streamer who is doing fine right now during the during the quarantine and during the epidemic. Yeah. So on June 12th, it will be available everywhere to everyone. You just get to choose who gets to benefit, what theater gets to benefit.
Daniel Karslake is the award-winning filmmaker behind such projects as For the Bible Tells Me So and Every 3 Minutes. His latest documentary is titled For They Know Not What They Do. Find out more at www.fortheyknow.org. Let me say it again. That's www.fortheyknow.org. Dan, thanks for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Weldon. It means the world to me. So wonderful to see you again. Thank you very much.
This week, Mayor Pete Buttigieg, military veteran and the first openly gay American to credibly run for president, spoke with Interfaith Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline on the Facebook Live series, Stay Home, Stay Focused.
You've started this PAC, Win the Era. I have to admit that when I saw it, I thought you were advocating for the Equal Rights Amendment. But that's not what this PAC is, right? Tell me a little bit about it.
Yeah, for the record, I passionately support the Equal Rights Amendment. But this was about an idea that was important to me, certainly during the time I was a candidate, that what's at stake in an election, especially in these times, is not just who's going to be in an office for 4 or 8 years or which party wins, but really what the next period in the life of our country is going to look like. I believed that in 2019. I really believe that now that we know what we're facing in 2020. That the decisions that are about to be made by policymakers in the next couple of years, and certainly across the 2020s, I think are going to decide what our political and cultural and social and economic arrangements are going to look like really for the next 50 or more years. We just happen to live at one of those hinge points that is very stressful and full of anguish at the time, but also will be remembered, I think, as being decisive. A friend of mine joked that living in this moment with this chaos might be us being punished in some cosmic way for ever telling our parents that we envied them for living in the 60s. And I think we're just in one of those moments where what's at stake is going to really telescope into the future. So that was why in my speeches, I always talked about winning the era. And that's why that was the name for this effort. So in addition to remaining involved in the presidential campaign, even though I'm not on the list now to be the nominee, I also think it's very important to be paying attention to other races, too. I believe there's a paradox going on right now. On one hand, we have never seen such remarkable examples of the importance of offices that don't get a lot of attention. The importance of, for example, county officials and state officials who, in American democracy, for better or worse, are the ones who run elections. The fact that mayors and governors, especially in the face of what I regard as a horribly costly failure of leadership at the federal level, those mayors and governors have stepped up to deliver. And of course, as somebody who cut my teeth in the unglamorous sometimes spaces of municipal government, I'm a big believer in the power of offices that don't get as much attention. The paradox is while we're seeing more than ever how important they are, there's less attention and resources available than ever, because to the extent I think that the American people can handle making room in our attention span for any election, there's just one that we're paying attention to. And again, that's an all-important race, but you know, we can't treat the presidency like the only office that matters. And so the idea of Win the Era is to make sure we're supporting efforts that look at some of those other races too. And I think it's a great way to practice what I was always preaching, even when I was a presidential candidate, saying that we could just think about the presidency.
Among the excitement that was generated by your campaign, Mayor Pete, was your willingness to talk about faith and to talk about it as a motivator, not as a campaign issue. Why did you do that?
Well, at the outset, I didn't realize that this was going to be seen as a hallmark of our campaign. I was just trying to be transparent about my own formation. And I felt that faith had been sometimes reduced, almost that God had been shrunken in the minds of some into this political corner, as though God belonged to a political party, as though faith required of you that you that you line up in a certain way. And I certainly feel that a lot of the commitments that I have as a matter of faith are deeply political. They have a lot of implications for the choices we make. But first, I just wanted to explain how I was formed. And I thought it was important to be transparent about that. I tread carefully on this because I know why there's an allergy, especially in my party, to talking about faith. A careful and I think well-founded desire to make sure we are attentive to the separation of church and state. The awareness, and this is certainly part of the LGBTQ community that I belong to, of the harm done when somebody is expected to live according to somebody else's interpretation of their own religion. So I understand all of those reasons why we've been allergic to talking about this, but having seen faith used as a cudgel in so many ways, and having felt called in my own understanding of how the world works and what's responsible or what we're responsible for, having felt called to pay attention to the least among us and the call to measure our worth in many ways based on what we have to offer to those who are most marginalized, I thought it was important to explain where that came from. And somewhat to my surprise, it wound up resonating in such a way that it was, I would say, one of the top two or three things when I was shaking hands on a rope line after an event, large or small, always one of the top things that somebody would come up and say that they appreciated us giving voice to.
Early on in your campaign, as you were sort of feeling your way into this unexpected attribute, you made an evaluative statement about the faith of our current president, which we at Interfaith Alliance objected to in terms of a public statement by a political candidate. We sent you a letter. I imagine you didn't see it. But I want to tell you that we got such blowback from our constituency about criticizing you about that. I wonder if you can unpack the critique that we received for doing that, the response to criticizing you for being so forthright.
Well, I think, first of all, I understand why there is a lot of concern about any situation in which somebody is even tiptoeing near discussing the faith or faithfulness of another. And I'm mindful also that the Christian tradition that I belong to and imperfectly adhere to has a little bit to say about pointing out the speck in your brother's eye, which unfortunately is a really big part of politics and campaigning.
Yep.
But I also felt like it was important to assert the warping that had happened in terms of just the space between the ways in which religion was being used certainly by this president and some of his followers, and what not just his espoused or ostensible faith, but any faith might ask of us. And, you know, frankly, I saw again just in the last few days what I took to be a pandering look. I think all of us are eager to be in our communities of faith and physical gathering when it can be safely done. But what I took to be a very political maneuver by the president, claiming that he had the power to order all of the churches and houses of faith back open. And then when the sun came up on Sunday, as far as anybody can tell, there's no evidence of him going anywhere but the golf course.
Right.
I do think that this needs to be discussed, that there has to be some relationship between who somebody is and what somebody says. And if that brings us into turf that is problematic, I welcome that conversation, because I think we do ethically need to hold each other accountable for how we treat each other, even if, or especially if, we're talking about presidential candidates. But I also think there has to be somebody's got to call the question, and I wasn't sure who else was going to do it.
I want to ask you a little bit about being a gay man. Is it important for us to notice that you're gay, or is it important for us to notice that we shouldn't notice that you're gay?
You know, it's a question that I've wrangled with a lot, too, because I think, you know, in many ways, it was especially affirming of the progress that has been made, although there's a long way to go, in equality that a lot of coverage and a lot of discussion of my candidacy barely even mentioned or didn't mention that dimension of my identity. And on the other hand, I think it was important to many of my supporters, and it's important to me, that it be noticed that this was something that not only would I have been the first out president, but really in terms of an elected official, was the first to make the attempt, and that this represented a step forward in a very long road that has me benefiting from paths that were carved by so many others, and also mindful of how much longer that road is, especially for many very marginalized parts of the same big LGBTQ+ family, whose lived experience is very different from mine. When we think about the violence against Black trans women, we are linked in one way and have radically different life experiences in so many other ways, and yet it's precisely for that reason that I know we need to stand together. And so the approach that I tried to take to this was to neither hide in any way from the importance of this part of who I am, nor to allow it to define us, in the same way that, you know, when Chasten first kind of came on the scene here in South Bend and was the first gentleman, certainly the first same-sex first gentleman that the city had ever seen, that, you know, a difficult, informal, unofficial, unwritten role that the spouse of the mayor plays. You know, our approach, we decided, was simply to conduct ourselves like any other couple. We felt like any other couple, and went through so many of the same challenges and blessings that couples do, and basically invite people to treat us accordingly. So I don't think there is an answer to, I don't think it's as simple as trying to not see it. But I do think that so much depends on being able to bring ourselves to a place where it's not any more defining than somebody would want it to be. And maybe that's what being gay has in common with other parallel, but of course different forms of difference when it comes to identity.
Let me ask you a slightly less awkward question, I hope, and that is about your military service. This is not a destination of choice for a lot of folks who have other opportunities. Can you make the case for people choosing a period of service to this nation in the military or in some other form?
Well, the biggest thing I would say is that we need more shared experiences. And one thing that you can get in the military, and one of the reasons I believe very strongly in creating more opportunities for voluntary or civilian national service too, is the experience of working on something hard with other people. I think nothing bonds you more closely to others than doing something together under challenging conditions. And the thing about the military is it brings people together who may have nothing in common besides the simple fact of being American. And I had to form not just working relationships, but relationships of deep trust with people who were radically different from me, different racially, different parts of the country, different generations, definitely different politics, and learn to trust one another with our lives. And at a moment when we have actually less and less shared experience, less and less from the fact that we don't all watch the same network news at the end of the day, to the fact that there's more and more kind of social and social media stratification, I think anything that helps you cut across that is really meaningful and formative, in addition to the simple fact that I believe for all of our faults and challenges, many of them on display right now. I believe in the American project, and one of the ways to serve it is to help secure it. And if that isn't for everybody, then again, so many other forms of service are out there. And I hope that as a nation, especially figuring out how to do things like scale up the number of people we're going to need for effective contact tracing, just to take one example, I hope we don't miss the opportunity to call more people into service, because it can make a difference to not just the individuals involved, not just those who benefit from the service itself, but I think to the very social fabric of this country.
So you're looking at a more distant horizon than I am at my age. What is going to bring us together on a day-to-day basis, not just in service to the country, as this pandemic begins to dissipate, but not disappear?
Well, I think it's going to be a combination of the pressure of the circumstances we're in and some sense of hope that we can get to a better place. I don't believe our objective should be to go back to wherever we were a year ago. I don't think it's possible. I don't think it's desirable. We are where we are, including our, frankly, vulnerability and weakness as a country, and the disparate vulnerability and weakness of so many who are already marginalized or oppressed in our society. We're there because of all these fissures that the virus both exposed and exploited in order to spread. The fact that there aren't worker protections meant that more people went in without the benefit of a sick day and were more liable to contract and to spread the virus. Just to take one example of conditions that were wrong anyway, but now we have yet another powerful example of why, and a chance to change them. So I think what's going to have to bring us together is an awareness of what we're trying to get to on the other side. Most of us know what it is we're against. I think we got to make sure we have a deeper sense of what we're for. And actually, we have more in common when we look at it that way. I remember moments when I would be on the campaign trail in a place like rural Iowa, one in particular, when I called on somebody and just a split second after I called on for a question, noticed that he had a Trump hat on. And I thought, well, wish I hadn't done that. He had a question about Social Security. He was worried about where we were headed and may or may not have decided to vote Democrat this time around. But whatever had gotten him to that place that he was in the last election, there was a chance to call him in this election. And I think that there's a chance, without giving an inch on our values or the things that we believe in, to call more people to our side in the service of what we all actually want to get to, which is a better place that is that has opportunity for everybody and is more inclusive. And look, there will be fights along the way. There will inevitably be fights on the way, especially if there are people unwilling to let go of the privileges and the prerogatives of injustices that we sat on and tolerated for too long. But I have to believe, if any of this is worth doing at all, as a country or as a species advancing, that we can find that common ground in the name of the things that we can and must deliver by way of a better life. And those choices, while they are deeply political, don't always have to be as divisive as they've been up to now.
The full archive of the Interfaith Alliance Facebook Live series, Stay Home, Stay Focused, is available online at www.stayhomestayfocused.org. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. I must confess to you that I began today's program somewhat stunned, sad, and preoccupied with what's happening in our nation. I find it more than difficult to believe that in just over 3 months, our nation has lost the lives of well over 100,000 people. Death is not easy. As a minister for over 50 years, I have conducted funeral services for more people than I can count. Never have I treated anyone's death or celebration of life as a perfunctory event. All people are created equal. Each life is sacred. So yes, every death is difficult. Grieving the loss of a life hurts like hell. Someone is gone who will not come back. I honestly cannot imagine the long-term consequences that will follow the anguish of a country of citizens who, in a little over 3 months, have had to say a final goodbye to over 100,000 people. Sadly, many of the ways that usually help people deal with grief are missing in this moment. Seeking comfort is impossible for scores of people who have lost their jobs and are worried about the security of their families. Numerous people have not even had the benefit of attending the funeral of their friends and family members. Why the divisive tactics and bitter language of the President of the United States could not even set aside his horrific attacks on people who disagree with him long enough to speak softly and honestly to the citizens of this nation who need to hear a comforting and assuring word from the leader of our nation. It was not easy to get ready for State of Belief today, but I'm glad we were together. I find it helpful to interact with all of you who are listening. You are people who want a better nation, who know how to say to their neighbor, "I'm sorry, can I help you?" You are people who think compassionately and cherish honesty. We will get through this difficult time together. I'm glad to be with you. Next week, we'll be right here with State of Belief again. Now, if you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say a very sincere thank you. Your generous support of this program is vital to keeping us on the air. If you think there's value in what you've heard here and you think it's important that others hear it as well, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And do you know someone who you think might benefit from hearing what you're hearing? Please commit to sharing State of Belief with just one person this week. With so many of us struggling with isolation, it can be very helpful to hear encouraging words and civil conversations around the issues we all care about the most. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.